Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by Peter Turo, and we are talking all about Castle Rock Season 2. This is the season that premiered in 2019, and, you know, we haven't heard much about this show since, but Peter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Deanna. How are you?
Good. You know, Castle Rock is one of those shows that I just enjoy talking about because it's not an adaptation in the sense of it taking King's works and doing a sort of direct adaptation. It's more like, here's Stephen King's sandbox and you can play in it.
Yes, yes. Which lends itself to a lot of really interesting combinations and dynamics with a lot of different characters.
Yeah, and they aren't shying away from big characters we're already familiar with, especially in season two. You know, this revolves around Annie Wilkes, and you have this whole story of this character pre-Misery. And I really love that they did that because, you know, we can make educated guesses as to what Annie was like pre-Misery. But this really just solidifies sort of everything I think a lot of people thought after either reading the book or watching the movie.
Oh, for sure. And one of my absolute favorite things about the Misery book is when Paul finds her, you know, memory lane photo album about like all of the things that happened in her past that you sort of come to realize she had done in terms of the people that she had targeted slash killed, all the records she kept of herself. And even with this, it's not the exact story, but there's a lot of things you'd think, oh yeah, Annie probably wouldn't have put anything about Joy if she pre-existed in the books in that. And so it's still like tracks, even though it's different, it still made complete sense in the way that she ends up being by the end of the series.
And I want to say this cast is absolutely amazing.
Stacked.
It really is, because you have Lizzie Kaplan as Annie Wilkes. You have Elsie Fisher as Joy Wilkes. And, you know, Elsie was kind of going off the charts at this time because of eighth grade and some other stuff she had been in. You have Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins, welcoming back to the fold of the Stephen King universe.
Yes, I loved it. Matthew Allen, John Hoogenacre. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing that right.
I just love seeing that name spelled. It was lovely to see.
Yeah, you have Paul Sparks. And I apologize sincerely if I pronounce these next two names wrong, but you have...
I can do one for you for sure, I know. Barkhad Abdi.
Yes, thank you. And then you have Yusra Warswama.
I think that's right.
I hope so. I'm terrible with names.
This was the only thing I'd seen her in, so I wasn't sure.
Yeah, you know, everyone just really plays their characters well in this season. And obviously the Merrill family is a family name we're very familiar with throughout Stephen King lore. And you even have a moment, and I forget which episode it is exactly, where someone comes knocking on the door and the guy announces himself as a bannerman, which is just like a fun little Easter egg. And we don't even really see the person. It's like you see his arm or torso or something, and that's it, really. And, you know, they just put in these little Easter eggs that I really, really enjoy, especially, you know, with the characters and everything. But, you know, that's kind of the core cast there, and I think they do a really, really great job.
Absolutely. And you forget there's really only a few Castle Rock books. And so the fact that he has already in this one town with just this limited scope of his works, a lot of names that just automatically bring that quick sort of, you know, it's just a familiarity, and it reminds yourself that he really does have this giant world to play with, where any one little name is going to conjure up a whole bunch of like feelings and stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I had seen some of the cast in other things either before or since this, and I think they really found people who weren't immensely popular or immensely well known at the time. It's like, you know, Paul Sparks had been in House of Cards, but he wasn't a main character in that, really.
Right.
He was definitely like in a supporting role. And, you know, like I said, Elsie Fisher is kind of on the up and up by that point. And Lizzie Kaplan, I have since seen in an Apple TV Plus show called Truth Be Told. And, you know, I'm sure she's been in quite a few other things that I'm just spacing on.
Had you ever seen Party Down?
I have not.
Oh, that was like a show. It used to be on Stars years ago, but that was, you know, Jane Lynch and her. And it was this, what's his name? From Parks and Rec. Oh, good. Adam Scott. Like, it was this whole group of, like, comedians that have now become so big, but that they started as, like, these little cater waiters on this show. And that was where, at least I had first seen Lizzie Caplan.
Yeah, and she had a pretty big role in Masters of Sex, which is probably what most people would have seen her in, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most mainstream thing I think she had done before this.
Yeah, so, you know, she had made a name for herself, at least somewhat, before this. But, you know, I think with this being on Hulu and, you know, I think it was maybe a little more accessible than
for sure.
Masters of Sex. But, you know, she gives an absolutely outstanding performance, and you can really tell that this character becomes Kathy Bates' iteration of the character that we see in the Misery movie, and it's just so fantastic.
Oh yeah, especially like just the way that she, I love the walk that she has. It's sort of this very deliberate sort of like march.
Yeah.
It's like a clotting almost. And it just really, like, you can hear Kathy Bates walking like that. It's she's very much not doing an imitation, but her behavior is informing the character, which is really wonderful to watch.
Yeah. And not only is the cast good, but I think the story does a really nice job of going in depth with this one specific character, but still giving us both Castle Rock stories and Salem's Lot stories.
We got the Marston house right there.
Yeah, because, you know, I never really thought about the proximity of a lot of these cities in, mm-hmm. you know, King's fictional Maine, if you will. And mm-hmm. to just have them be right there, you're like, oh, okay, this is much closer than I expected. And, you know, I know some books will have maps, like Under the Dome has a map at the front of the book.
Right.
You'd probably have to like get multiple books that have maps and sort of like
piece
it all together. And so I like that they give you that added element to it as well, because it's not just a Castle Rock story even though it is the Castle Rock show. What did you think about sort of just bringing in this whole different element of King's world?
It's one of my absolute favorite things that Stephen King does, is have this expanded universe where, you know, on different levels of the tower, things are just like in the same universe. And I love his Maine. Like, Stephen King's Maine is wonderful. I kind of expected them to throw in a dairy character at some point in all of this. But there's something really wonderful about taking people who have these established stories, very, like, you know, Ace Merrill is in a bunch of books and is very, you know, clearly defined in a bunch of things. And just thinking, hey, how would he be in a scene with Annie? And it's just, it's also a great testament to King's like late 80s, early 90s run of just like really solid works. And so it's taking some of his best stuff and giving us this, you know, really fun sandbox, like you said, to play with.
Yeah, I'm curious if you thought this as well, but, you know, I had watched this before when it came out, so I knew the answer the second time around. But did you feel like there was something off between the Annie and Joy relationship from the beginning? Because to me, it always felt like Joy was way too old to be Annie's kid. And it felt pretty obvious from the start.
When I first watched the show, I had only made it through the first three episodes. And then, you know, life happened and I didn't finish it. And so this time, it's more obvious the second time you watch it, for sure. She definitely is a little too old. Also, again, I'm going in with my preconceived notions of, well, you know, Joy didn't exist when I read Misery. And in my mind, I'm like, well, yeah, she wasn't her actual daughter. So there's not, you know, Annie, I think in her mind was able to sort of keep that separate. You know, she knows, even though she's treating her like her daughter, like in her heart of hearts, she knows this is my sister and we're not, you know, not owe her the bond that the mother-daughter has. That's the wrong way to say that. But it was quite obvious the way that Lizzie Caplan was playing it that, you know, there was a thing to be discovered about this, because it couldn't just be as simple as this is my daughter and we're running from a man. Annie wouldn't run from a man.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of a funny little lie she was telling the entire time. And it's like, no, you would have just killed the man.
You would have just killed him. Like I think we established in that episode pretty early on, you would have just killed him.
Yeah, and you know, it isn't until episode 5 that you get the flashback to Annie's childhood. You know, you see her as a teen and she's struggling with reading. And I mean, you see her even before that as a younger child in elementary school when she's kind of being kicked out of school. And her mother and father are both in different kinds of denial when it comes to Annie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I thought they did a very nice job of displaying that because it caused all of this tension within the relationship. It really, you know, made Annie pick a side, basically. And she obviously picked her dad. And, you know, given what he did, and we will get to that in a bit.
Yeah.
And also the twist at the end. There's lots of little twists in this, aren't there?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They do keep you guessing far past when you think that you've solved it completely.
Yeah, but Annie is really forced to pick sides here. And, you know, that's like the worst thing you can do to a kid.
Oh, absolutely. It's like, I know that we had sort of, I brought it up briefly when we did Sleeping Beauties, that, you know, the moment that Lila sort of gives the truth to her son and sort of like is wanting him to pick a side. And you're like, no, parents aren't supposed to do that. No. But her, and you can sort of see, like, you know, when you know what kind of character Annie becomes, she really, you know, doesn't seem to have any other, you know, women in her life. And she sort of like has taken on, you know, the character of Misery as this bastion of morality and behavior. And she sort of, it's like, her mother sort of got her to like, oh, no, women aren't good for me. I don't think I need to be around you. Like it's, she focuses on her father. I think every man in her life becomes a variation of her father. And it's just, it's a really interesting way to show how just from such early on, Annie really like, because of her family, she really didn't have a lot of choices in terms of how she turned out.
Yeah. And they give you a ton of information in that episode. And, you know, it's kind of closing out the first half of the season since this is 10 episodes. And, you know, we see her parents hire Rita, who is played by the same actress who plays Sadie in 11-22-63. I'm totally spacing on her name, though.
Oh, let me double check, because I kept her. She sounded like Julie Benz, and then when she said her character name was Rita, I was like, wait a second, because like her name is, that's her character on Dexter. Sarah Gadden. There you go. Yeah, Sarah Gadden. She is younger than me. How dare. Oh.
Yeah. So she is also returning, like Tim Robbins, and you know, her appearances in King Things much closer together than Tim Robbins.
Yes.
But, you know, to have that twist where we find out Joy is Rita's daughter, Evangeline, and, you know, Annie's dad had an affair with basically her tutor, you know, that just puts such a big emphasis on, you know, that first half of the season. Because even though we start off in a very different place, you know, you have Annie and Joy getting in the car accident and that strands them in Castle Rock. She attacks
in a fun
Ace
little
Merrill.
Nod to Misery. She gets in her, she gets in a car accident that time. And yep, and the attack on Ace.
Yeah, and there's just so much that happens in a lot of these episodes, really. I was like trying to write everything down and I was like, wow, they're really going through a lot here. And I think that
it gets stacked.
That helps with the pacing, though.
Yeah. You also, I mean, I like how, you know, like a good show that has all these umbrella storylines going on. You have to, you know, isolate certain things at certain times in order for them to be able to connect seamlessly by the time you get to the end. And so to get the end that we had, we needed to have these sort of like super packed episodes so then we can follow the little trails later on and figure out when they're gonna, you know, come up and connect to us.
Yeah, and that flashback placement in episode 5 was smart too, because in episode 4, that's when Nadia is attacked and finds out that Pop killed her and Abdi's mom, and you have this tense moment that doesn't get resolved, and you know it's going to come back around later. And, you know, Pop adopting two kids after taking in, you know, his sister's kids, you can tell he's going through a lot and he's trying to atone for things that he's done or things that someone else has done in the case of his brother-in-law. And, it's hard because we've kind of been trained to not like the Merrill family by this point.
Yeah, they're in the general lexicon of King stuff, they're sort of like the, you know, oh, no, we don't vibe with those people.
Absolutely. But then you have Chris and Pop in this, who are both very likable. Ace still not.
No, and never will be. There is no good version of Ace Merrill.
Yeah, and then you have this whole sort of Salem's Lot storyline, too, with the Marston house and people being taken over and coming back to life. And did you at any point feel like it was too much, though?
I think they didn't as clearly establish that part of it, mainly because we did get the flashback to Amity so late in the season. And we got it right after we got a full episode flashback of Annie. And then we have sort of like an episode breather where there's story happening again. And then it's basically another full episode flashback. And so I think they packed a little bit into there. That was a little much. I wouldn't have minded, you know, scaling back a couple of the other stories a little bit just so I could actually know. I didn't really feel like I knew who anyone really was before they got possessed. Like, I know it's the real estate lady. I know it's Abdi's, you know, foreman kind of guy. But I don't know their names. Like, I couldn't tell you, you know, actual character information about them. They just sort of become faceless soldiers, which is fine. But yeah, I would have liked just a little bit more investment in some of the people that were turning.
Honestly, I can barely tell you the names of the souls that took over their bodies, you know, even.
Right. Yeah. I had to look up. I'm like, oh, Etienne. Okay. I knew Amity because, you know, I have the name on the coffin and everything still.
Yeah. That helps when they just tell you and they're like, here is the name. Thank you.
And here is that name.
You know, it did feel like a little too much by the time we kind of get to episode 7 and you're like, oh, wait, you're just now giving us this and we only have 3 episodes right left.
Yeah, it's like, and then it sort of just becomes that, you know, the sort of, it's becoming sort of like the late stage King trope where it all just leads up to a giant battle at the end. And it's like, I know that it's going to get there, but I want to think for a second that they're not going to succeed. Like our heroes, I want for a moment to actually believe that they're going to lose. And I don't think we really get that as much as I would have really liked to.
Right. What did you think of how they end up tying this to season 1?
I was really hoping that they would, and I wasn't sure when the season started, you know, besides like the references to Shawshank and everything. I didn't know how much they were going to. I mean, I love Frances Conroy. I'll watch her when she's in anything. I like that they use Dale Lacy. Like, I'm a sucker for a character that is gone in the first 5 minutes of a story and then turns out to have information that people needed. So I kind of love that. I don't know why they didn't just get Pop in the first place, because he knows where everything is. And it's one of those, like, they extended the story when they didn't need to. It didn't make completely narrative sense. But So here's my thing I wanted to ask you about that. So I honestly, like, fist pumped, cheered when I saw Bill Skarsgård. I always love seeing him, and he's got that face that's just like so weird. But then I had to think, I'm like, but wait, why was he locked up if he can like disappear by the end of it? Like, did he need to be freed? Was there a thing like there was a protocol he sort of was following? That part didn't quite work as well for me. But I did like seeing him and knowing that he was related. I loved seeing the missing poster for, you know, the Andre Holland version of Henry Deaver. That was a nice little Easter egg. But I always enjoy when an anthology show sort of connects back to the other versions of it or the other seasons of it.
Yeah, I think they didn't wrap it up quite as well as I was hoping either, because, yeah, you know, we see him at the end of the flashback, you know, mm-hmm, when we're going back to, what is it, like 1893 or something,
right,
like that, you know? So, you know, he's going to come into play, but then it's like Ace or whoever has taken over Ace at that point goes to the jail and he visits the hole, but, you know, the kid isn't in there.
No, and he should have known that. Like, that's the thing. Like, it happened. I want to know the time frame, because, like, at this point, like, if you know about Dale, if you know about the wife, if you know about these other things, how can you not know that the kid isn't there anymore? Like, he was let out very early on.
I want to know why the prison opened back up.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would assume it's just like, you know, Shawshank just makes a lot of bad decisions and Castle Rock leadership is probably more like, shh, no, let's get back to normal. Just like open it back up.
Yeah, because, you know, at the end of season 1, we see Henry Deaver take the kid back there and nobody's at the prison. So he had to have gone somewhere since then and the prison had to have opened back up.
Right. And now with Henry missing, you know that something happened with that. But it's, Yeah, there wasn't enough. I also, like, at this point, I kind of expected them to at least reference Pangborn or something. I'm like, he is one of the most famous king characters of all time. I would have, like, thought that he'd at least mention, like, demerit a mention with, like, things happening since he died. But
yeah,
you can't have everything.
Pangborn didn't get a mention, but we see his name in episode 9 when Pop has all those letters because they were, like,
yes.
Pangborn and Lacey, but no one ever, like, says his name or anything like that.
Yeah, it just felt weird, like, for having it be a, you know, especially with Ace, they're just like, it's also I Have Needful Things on the Brain since it was a recent read, and I really love Pangborn, and I wish that we could have more of him.
Yeah, and I think this show does that kind of ending that a lot of King books do, where you think it's ended, and then there's an epilogue.
Right, and I didn't need a full episode of an epilogue. Like, they finish... the plot within the first 10 minutes of the episode. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, what else is going to happen?
Yeah, it's a pretty lengthy, like, after events kind of thing. Because at the end of episode 9, we see, you know, Ace confronting Pop and he's deteriorating mm-hmm. very quickly. And episode 10 is where they plant all of the bombs and, you know, they're trying to basically disrupt this ceremony that's happening between Joy and Ace, who, you know, obviously aren't themselves at this moment in time. And
no,
they cross the railroad tracks and you're like, okay, it's over. And then you're like, okay, it's not.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I like that they, you know, it's like, oh, this is a thing we used to do when we were kids. But, like, couldn't you have maybe shown that in the flashback to you two being kids that we saw? Mm-hmm. That would have been nice, like narrative connection, at least for a viewer to be like, oh, that's a thing that we saw them do. That's probably going to come back at some point. But, you know, it didn't. Yeah, it kept going and it didn't need to. And all of, I just have a thing in general with especially, like, fiction where you just, Why would these people know how to fire guns? Why would these people know how to set up explosives? Like, it's never established that Nadia would know how to... She shoots so many people by the end of this.
Yeah, they would establish it with Abdi, basically, because
yeah.
we see him get a gun in the flashbacks. And so, you know, he kind of already has that mentality. And I chalked it up to Pop teaches all of the kids how to shoot. That's kind of just what I went with.
I would have been like, they would have gone hunting with him or something like that. And I would assume, like, the real estate business in Castle Rock requires Abdi to know how to fire a gun.
You know,
like, someone at some point is going to try to shoot at you.
I was like, okay, either Pop taught them or it's just Maine, you know?
Yep. This is just, hey, this is Stephen King's Maine. Everyone knows how to shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of the reasoning I went with. But yeah, they left a bunch of little things like that kind of unresolved or, you know, left us with questions. And to talk about the twist at the end for this epilogue, mm-hmm. and, you know, then we can kind of go back and revisit some things we maybe skipped over. But
sure,
we have this sort of quote unquote epilogue, and Annie and Joy are just going off because at this point, Annie just straight up killed Rita.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Rita gets the shortest end of the stick in this story, even though, you know, she had an affair with Annie's dad. Not great, but people are human.
Right, but it's hardly, like, a killable offense.
Yeah, and she finds her daughter, doesn't really get to spend that much time with her.
No.
And you have Joy going through this struggle, too. So I think Joy and Rita are kind of, like, the two who just get the crappiest storylines, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Rita gets an episode and a half, maybe, and both times she ends it with getting an injury to the stomach.
Yeah. Annie literally had to try again to succeed in killing her.
Oh, and then that's a parallel to draw when we talk about the twist ending.
Yeah.
Annie just tries and tries till she succeeds.
She really does.
She doesn't give up. That Annie, well, she doesn't give up. But poor Rita also, like, they have her relapse almost immediately as well, which, you know, again, she's human, it happens. But then poor Joy, who every one of her decisions when she's trying to, you know, she's a teenager who does not have a fully formed brain, who is going through highly emotional things that no human person goes through. And then people are expecting her to communicate effectively. It's like, no. She doesn't know what's going on. She's not going to tell you flat out what's going on. And, you know, it's so sad by the end because Elsie Fisher is just, she has such a beautiful naturalness to her. And she really does seem like every kid you went to school with.
Mm-hmm.
And having, you know, I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and some of them are hitting the age now where I'm like, oh, you're just not going to talk to me for a couple of years. Okay. All right. Yeah. Feelings aren't a thing anymore until you're, okay, cool. And so I just saw so much of that in this. I'm like, oh, she's such a ball of emotions, and she has no idea how to talk about it.
Absolutely. And you have her stuck with Annie after this because she doesn't know anything else. She truly doesn't.
Mm-mm-mm. All she knows is she committed murder and doesn't know why. Oh, because that's the thing, like, where she's aware that she killed, like, because she killed Ace, right? And she's aware that she did it.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess technically she's the one who killed Rita, too, by accident.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that on her. That's such an, like, you, when you have a struggle thing like that in fiction, like, you know, that's always like, we'll never know who did it. It's like, no, she was, anything could have happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, you know, she's going to internalize that, and she's going to see that it's her fault, and no one will ever be able to convince her of anything else.
I still blame Annie for it. That's why I said that earlier.
It is very much Annie's fault. Annie, everything that happened in that sequence of events is Annie's driving that car.
Yeah.
And we don't want Annie driving a car. We know what happens when Annie drives a car.
And so in this epilogue, you know, she takes Joy, and it's clear that Joy doesn't really want to talk about this stuff and doesn't really want to spend all that much time with Annie anymore because she has seen what this sort of life is like when she's not confined to everything Annie wants her to do, because she made friends in Castle Rock and she went out and she had fun and she did things. And now they go to this very, very beautiful home, you know?
Oh my goodness, I wanted to summer there. I'm like, can I please come visit?
Yeah, but not die.
No. I will not go swimming with anyone else.
No. And so she is back in her sort of nurse role, which I truly do not understand how she was able to get so many nursing jobs.
I will tell you, I mean, let's imagine how, like, things are now when, like, things are tight and there's just, you know, they'll hire anyone who has a level of qualification. Imagine what it was like in the 80s when you couldn't really do a proper check on anything. It's like by the time they realize, you know, what's going on, she's already gone. But it's, yeah, and like them saying, oh, it's homebound, it's an older person. I'm like, no, this is how that starts. This is how that starts for her.
Yeah, so, you know, they get to live in the house. They don't have to go find another place. She's the live-in nurse, basically. And, you know, there's tension between her and Joy. And Joy tries to get away from her. And Annie just straight up thinks she's still, you know, the other person. And she just drowns her.
She just drowns her. She literally attacks her. She drugs her first. She drugs her with the ice cream. She tries to kill her on the couch first. It's like, again, she's a trier. Because she does it so physically, and it's like my whenever I think of Kathy Bates' performance of it, you think of her as just, she's got that, you know, I mean, I guess it's been called, like, you know, the sociopathic energy, like where it's this strength that just happens when it's all just adrenaline and you just can feel them rushing towards you and you can't get out of the way. And that's what it feels like when she does stuff like that. It's like, you are never going to get away from this. She's going to keep coming until she gets what she thinks is, you know, what she wants out of this. In this case, killing you so the demon is gone from you forever.
Yeah, it is truly wild what Annie Wilkes is capable of, because she is committed to everything.
She really is. And I could be wrong. I can't remember this exactly. I tried to double check and I forgot to finish the episode, to rewatch the episode. But does she, like, when she's saying, you know, mom, don't, and she says, I'm not your mom, does she say something like that? In my mind, that she does. Or she says something to the tune of that, to basically be like, she's in her brain, she is severing the connection that Joy thinks that they have as mother and daughter. And she's like, no, you're not my daughter. You are this person and I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, I think she does when they're in the water. And, you know,
yeah,
they're up in Canada, by the way. So they've, like, left Maine,
right,
left the country. And
yep.
You have this moment where, you know, Annie just goes back into the house and then suddenly realizes what she's done and goes back out and quote unquote revives Joy.
Oh yeah, but that's after she reads Joy's letter.
Yes.
That tells her that she was planning, the person she was talking to was the lawyer who was going to try to help her with emancipation.
Right. And so then, like, the light bulb goes off for Annie and she goes back and you know, they do a really good job of making you believe that she did revive Joy. But at the same time, I was like, she's been out there way too long.
I was going to ask you, I'm like, did you ever actually think that she was back?
The first time, it definitely got me a little bit, even though I was still skeptical because I was like, this was a long time.
Yes, yes, yes. And she is a young person. And that is, you know, she doesn't have, her lungs probably aren't as strong as an adult person's lungs would be.
Yeah. And then you have the conversation at the Paul Sheldon book signing, and mm-hmm. you have the guy walking up and saying, is this seat taken? And that's when you're like, oh, she's not there. Because then Annie's like, of course it is. And then you're like, he wouldn't be asking if someone was sitting there.
Right. Because you see her sit with Annie in the scene, and then the camera pans away to Paul. And then when you do the slow pan out and you see that she's sitting by herself. And I actually did really like the way that they revealed that. Like, even though I could see it coming and I knew it was going to happen, I was glad they waited till that last moment, because it really does just show, like, oh, Annie has now replaced her other obsessions with this new one, and she has completely shut out the rest of the world.
Yeah, she goes downhill very fast.
She is now living in the fantasy, and this is the Annie that I could buy. Okay, because now that she's into the Misery books, but like, this is the Annie that I can buy never bringing up Joy again. She's never, like, when she makes her scrapbook, she's never going to touch that. Like, I of course, like, made it all about, like, the established version of Annie that I already have in writing. But it tracked for me. Like, it made sense why Joy was never, you know, a thing anywhere else. Because, you know, she was also created for the TV show, so of course.
It was just so well done, even though I do think that epilogue was kind of a little too long.
I wanted to know, like, what happened to... The show didn't seem very interested in developing Nadia and Abdi on their own, so like, I'm kind of not surprised they didn't really get a satisfactory ending, at least for me, a satisfactory ending. They just almost were afterthoughts as major characters, so I didn't really expect that they'd get an ending that I would be satisfied with.
Yeah, I was hoping for like a shot of stuff going on in Castle Rock, mm-hmm. you know, just yeah. literally anything to
yeah.
sort of wrap up that part of the story, but they definitely wanted to focus more on Annie and Joy. And I get that. Yeah. But at the same time, I really, really ended up liking a lot of the other characters. And yeah, I was bummed they didn't do that.
Yeah, you've had to spend 10 episodes with these people, and now you're asking us to only care about a couple of them, how their story ends. Like, we know that Pop dies. We know that like all the cultists die, but like, what happens to the people who are left? And, you know, I mean, in my mind, I like to think, you know, Abdi may have been responsible for a lot of this destruction, but now he can come in and, hey, let's rebuild. My company can do it for you. So I kind of want I like the idea of Abdi just sort of taking over for, you know, both doing his own business, but taking over for Pop too.
Yeah.
Because the Merrills essentially get wiped out of the Stephen King universe after Needful Things. And so it's kind of, I like the idea that in the current day, somehow they still survive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Peter, is there anything you want to bring up that we maybe skipped over? I only have a couple scenes, I think, but I will let you go first.
Not really. We've sort of been hitting on some of my favorite things. I will say, I keep forgetting that when people do current flashbacks to children, that a CD-ROM is considered to be like an old device that signals the passage of time. And that's sort of like one of those things that just sort of hits me. I'm like, oh no, I'm old. Oh no, no, no. I don't like that. But other than that, I cede the floor to you.
Just another quick Easter egg here. You have Chance, who is Georgia LaChance. So
yes, from Stand By Me.
Yes,
or The Body.
Another tie back to The Body, and I just thought that was kind of a clever way to do that, because, you know, like we said, the Merrill family is a pretty big family, you know. Pop has been in other stories. Pop isn't a new addition. Ace has been around, and...
Well, Ace is the bad guy in Stand By Me. He's the one who tells him about the body.
Yeah. And so to have the LaChance family get a little nod in there too, I thought was nice. And they didn't focus on it. It was just like one little scene where we see her real name, and that's kind of it.
That's what I love about an Easter egg. Those are the ones that I really love.
Yeah, because it was literally Rita doing a reverse phone number search. And because mm-hmm. Chance gave Joy the phone, her name was the one on it. And so, you know, it was just a quick little thing that you very easily could have missed too if you weren't like paying attention at that very moment. And then I want to quickly talk about Pop's Living Wake. And
oh, yes.
Just because that was such a fun moment in a show that otherwise didn't have a ton of fun moments. And you see, I forget his name because I'm terrible at remembering names, but one of the boys who has befriended Joy, he's coming in and like taking the beer, and Pop's like, take some more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to lie. I don't remember any of those other kids besides Chance.
Yeah, I apologize. I am the worst with remembering names. I'm just like, oh, that one character from that other show I watched. I know that their other character name. I don't know their character name in this. But yeah, that was just a fun little moment. And I think
it's realistic.
Yeah. And it does make you like Pop a little more, even though you know he's done terrible things.
And I kind of like that they didn't make him, you know, like, yes, he's taken in, you know, in the books, you know, canonically he's taken in the two kids, but then when he takes in Abdi and Nadia in this version, I like that they don't make it be like, oh, he took them in because he was so big-hearted and blah, blah. Just like, no, he took them in and he was also a shit father. Like, it's okay to be both. And he's like, Pop is, you know, he's a complicated man, and he, you know, for better or worse, probably did the best that he could. It just wasn't a thing that he was ever going to be good at. But it's realistic. And I like that, you know, he would have these, like, relationships with people where at Awake, they probably tell, like, the great stories about him. And they'd also tell, like, the absolute horrible stories, you know, about how, you know, Pop could be such a, you know, so-and-so. But it feels real. It made him feel like a real part of the community. Because if people were coming to him, you know, at the Emporium, if they were, like, he's a junk trader. He knows all of, you know, he can infer a lot by what people are selling him and what he's selling to other people. So he's like, he just seems like he would be the, you know, a really great character to focus on for something like that. Like he's the man of town. And I really like that we got to have a scene like that.
Yeah. I also want to give a quick shout out to some of the gore effects in this, because when Annie shoves that ice cream scoop down Ace's throat, I was like,
oh, I jumped. That's like you grab your throat and you're like, oh no.
I'm like, this hurts me.
it's like, you feel like, oh, that's going to hurt to swallow. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think I read somewhere that, because I didn't remember it, but I guess that was an Easter egg as well, because I guess that's the way that Paul has a character get killed in one of his other books in Misery. Like he has someone get killed with an ice cream scoop down the throat. And so I thought when I read about that, I was like, oh, that's also a nice little thing for the close readers of Misery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Peter, anything else before we dive into ratings and wrap this up?
I just remembered in my notes, I had the phrase happy asshole written because it's one of my favorite. In my mind, it reminds me of Maximum Overdrive, because I know King used it in that. And so I always just equate that with, oh, he really does have those phrases that he loves. He really does. But when Pop calls himself that, I'm like, ah, that's a Stephen King line. Oh, Per Augustin was the name of the monk that's embodied Ace. Sorry, just had to look that up so I could close that circle.
Thank you for checking on that, because I would not.
You're welcome.
Gotten that correct at all. But ratings, you know, it seems like we both really enjoyed this, but it definitely has some flaws. So where does this sit for you?
I'm gonna give it a 3.5 out of 5, which is, for me, that means that I will definitely watch parts of it again, and that I will watch clips of it. Like, there's a certain rating system that I do internally where I'm like, did I like this enough to rewatch some of it? I think, you know, it definitely was underserved in terms of some of the characters. I feel like I didn't get enough time with Ace on his own before I cared what he was like as a possessed person. But I did love that he got killed right off the bat. But, you know, they didn't do enough with Nadia and Abdi, but I will give them all of the credit for Lizzie Kaplan's performance in this. She really embodied the Annie vibe and what I came to expect from a portrayal of Annie Wilkes.
I think they tried to cram a little too much in this, and I think I'm right in the same spot as you, 3.5 out of 5. And
yeah,
if they had maybe picked one or the other, I think they really could have gone a little deeper with some of these characters. But, you know, when you have Ace being killed right away, pretty much, mm-hmm. and then having to come back to life as someone else, it just kind of felt like we didn't get to dive into the Merrill family as much as I would have liked. We do get some stuff through Pop, right. basically.
But we've never really gotten, in physical media, we've never really gotten a whole lot of Pop outside of the book. So, like, it would have been nice to have, like, a little bit more establishment of that. Like, it's nice that we know who he is, but I would have liked a little more.
Yeah, so I kind of think that Salem's Lot story could have been replaced by more sort of character work with the Merrill family and really getting to know, you know, what it was like more for Nadia and Abdi growing up with Chris and Ace, because we hear about it, but we don't see it.
Yeah. I mean, Ace like essentially would kill Abdi if he had the chance. And that is a relationship that I want to know more about if they've spent 20 years being raised together.
Yeah. So this season was, I think, a little more packed than season one. And I really love a lot of parts of season one. Season one, I think, is a little more abstract than this one.
Yeah, well, it's dealt, I think, with a lot more of the philosophical stuff, and especially when you have, like, episodes like The Queen, like, that is, there are things at work that, this is more like a straight up, like, ghost story. Or they're working with, like, it's more of, like, the late 80s horror stuff, where I think season one really tried to, it was like, what does it mean to be in blah, 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 and it played more, I think, with the, you know, with the different universes. Quick question, though, for you, because this reminded me of this. I'm like, I kind of expected Jackie Torrance to show up again somewhere.
Yeah.
Because she was, like, such a nothing character in season one. And I thought there could have been a fun way to bring her in here. Like, replace the Marston House story with, like, something with The Shining if you're going to do, like, ghosts and stuff. Because you already have a character that's established.
Well, but I think that's because at the end of season one, she went to Colorado.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't have minded, like, a parallel to that. Because especially because in Misery, Annie Wilkes talks about the hotel that blew up. And it's a weird thing to have Annie be involved with, like, such supernatural stuff when that book was so realistic. But that was, like, as I'm thinking about this, that would have been an interesting through line to use Jackie and sort of, like, you know, I know from the books that The Shining and Misery take place in the same universe. So in retrospect, that could have been a cool thing to do.
Yeah, I totally get where you're coming from, but...
Oh, well.
I think, you know, it would be interesting if we got maybe a season three that kind of wrapped some things up in Castle Rock better.
And as I'm looking, I was looking at the Wikipedia, and unfortunately, it looks like back in November, the show was canceled, so I don't think we're getting one.
Yeah, I think pandemic killed a lot of plans.
It's like, this isn't a show that we need to really worry about coming back. Like, we can let this one go.
Yeah, and because they kind of formatted it as a mostly anthology thing, you know, even though season two tied to season one, it is still a pretty well-contained story. Like, you don't need to have seen all of season one to understand season two, in my opinion, but...
Oh, 100%.
You know, I think this was a fun little experiment, and I think, you know, it was just a nice thing to see, because there have been some adaptations that are derivatives of King's work that have been absolutely terrible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he has more bad adaptations than good.
I'm inclined to agree.
And it's a byproduct of, you produce such a large body of work.
Yeah.
And you know, it's his books are so, I don't know, everyone gets something different out of them, and none of us are, I think, are gonna be completely happy with any version of his stuff. So this is nice, like, we get these nice characters and, like, throw them in a sandbox and let's play.
That's very fair. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Castle Rock season two. It has been a blast getting to talk about this one with you.
Yes, I agree. Thank you very much for having me.